Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you literally from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, it is the first interview of 2020, the first interview of the decade for the Cave of Solitude, and I thought, why not bring in the new decade with none other than the rising star of Casey Parsons. Casey, thank you for coming to the show once again.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for having me. It's 2020? Is that what I heard?
That's right. The pressure is on. This is my first interview of the decade, so it's going to be a good one.
Well, I'm honored. I'm still in 1850.
How's the year been for you? since it's like literally the
since
beginning
yesterday?
Of January. Yeah, since yesterday, the beginning of January. What was 2019 like for you?
2019 was a great year for me. I think a lot of things are starting and taking off. I put a Facebook post up about some of the highlights, and I was going to do 9. I think I did 11, and it was hard to, you know, cut things out because I had so many kind of high moments, good moments last year, and I just hope to, you know, top that in 2020.
Yeah. Well, let's go through some of the highlights.
Some of the highlights.
2019. So when we spoke at Fan Expo, you said that you had an exciting announcement or something that was coming up potentially that you were going to be able to talk about after New York Comic Con.
Okay, that was likely the project we did for New York Comic Con. There was an exclusive launch at NYCC through Kirby's comic art team, where we had guest tables there in Artist Alley in New York. Phenomenal experience.
Was it your first time?
My first time. First time in New York, first time to that show.
First time in New York.
Yeah, so my mind was blown. I was going to tell you that earlier when we were talking about New York. But, so we were able to do, and I had no idea this was coming either beforehand, but we were just asked, you know, can you do a pinup of the Joker? We're like, okay, because the Joker movie was coming out,
right?
I believe, the Friday after that Comic-Con.
Okay.
Like Thursday, Friday, like the release was happening that week anyhow. And to coincide with that, we were asked to do a Joker pinup. Just what you think, your concept of the Joker, basically. There was no real direction. It was just have fun with it, see where it goes. And if you can get one in, then, you know, go for it. So I came up with a couple concepts, and I didn't know what this was going to be or what it was used for. Like, we were kind of left in the dark a little bit. We just knew our agent, Annabelle, was trying to prepare something for New York Comic Con, something special for us and for the team, something that would stand out a little bit. So I did a pinup of the Joker, and I did it 11 by 17, but I did it horizontally, which is a little unusual,
mm-hmm.
which would kind of screw myself over if this was going to be a comic cover or something, but I thought, everyone's going to be doing a vertical picture, right? So I did this horizontal thing, and I had this mixed media, again, like I like to kind of do more painterly approach, traditional approach, and I used a big fat red oil stick and had the Joker kind of smearing his lipstick on his face, like it was a Joker in profile, and I really... there's an homage there a little bit to the Dave McKean version of the Joker from Arkham Asylum.
Okay.
So that real twisted, dark, psychotic, you know, he's got that tiny little green eye, that real bloodshot eye, and just an insane face on him. I just wanted to make it as creepy as I could, you know, really capture that, just this little private moment with the Joker, or, you know, he's getting into character kind of thing, where he's always the psychopath, but he's getting into that. You know, he's putting his kind of mask on, right? The lipstick. And so what ended up happening was that piece ended up going in a DC-licensed portfolio that was exclusive to the Comic-Con. So there was whoever part of the team at the time that showed up to New York and was able to sign. So it was exclusive to 100 copies, 100 prints. And... so mine was in there. There was David Mack, Gillian March, Tomeo Mori, Ingrid, and Stephanie Lavod, and
it was
like
nice,
a really, really strong team of artists.
And they're all represented by Kirby Yard?
All represented by Kirby Yard.
Wow.
She's got quite a few now on the team. There's been a couple new people lately. So check it out, though, if you haven't. So Kirby's Art, kirbyscomicart.com, or on Facebook, it's the same thing, Kirby's Comic Art. And you can see who she's got on the roster, like Gabriel Delato and Ruin. And yeah, a lot of big names.
So
Gerald Perel.
Were you able to schmooze with all these guys in New York?
I schmoozed, yes. And I made that my mission when I went to New York. I'm going to schmooze. A lot of schmoozing. So David Macca was really nice to get to meet him. He's one of the, obviously, one of the top names on the team, like the most known household name. But I also got to meet Jason Sean Alexander right behind us. So I kind of hung out with him a little bit. I met Dennis Kitchen.
Was that your first time meeting Jason Sean Alexander?
I've met him before and bought some art off of him before, but I'm a big, big fan.
I listened to our first interview that we did, and you had mentioned that he's a big inspiration for you, so that's kind of cool that you got to meet him.
And I'm trying hard not to clone the guy, but I feel like we're kindred spirits a little bit. I mean, we both like our whiskey, traditional art. I mean, he's a classy gentleman. I attempt to be a classy gentleman.
You're a classy gentleman.
I have a lot of influences, but he's kind of like one of the younger guys that's becoming really big now, who I've kind of emulated a little bit. I'm like, I'm just enjoying his career, watching that happen, and I love seeing, like, he's willing to share how he works, and you know, and I incorporate a little bit of that. And I'm not the kind of guy who would just copy and do exactly what he does all the time, but I want to see what I like about that and what I could use, and you know, and then mix it up with other stuff that I gather. Like Bill Sienkiewicz is another fellow who I had the wonderful pleasure of meeting and even drawing beside
this year. Tell me about that.
And he's another massive influence. He's like a comic god, a legend, and just but a real down-to-earth, super nice guy, like a very, very genuine, lovely person. So that came about in a very weird way. I was following George Pratt on Instagram. So I'm also a fan of George Pratt and his painterly style and comics. I love these guys like Kent Williams and you know, John Bolton and you know, John Muth and you know, these painterly guys, these sort of darker guys, the guys who are classically trained. And I put Bill somewhere in there. Bill's kind of his own kind of monster, but
you know his work immediately when you see it. If you're comics, like his stuff's iconic.
And I mean, you never know what you're going to get with him, and his styles are kind of all over the place. Not all over, but he's got a kind of an infinite way of working, but you always know it's him.
Yeah.
Admire that.
When he inks stuff, it doesn't matter who's he's inking over, you know that it was him.
Yeah, I find there's only a few guys in the industry like that. Like, and Dave McKean, I think, is one of them too, where, and I said this to Dave McKean, I got to meet him, like, you're able to articulate the subconscious in a sense. Like, these guys are able to almost tap into something. It's in our primal visual core, and pull that out and you know, render it somehow. Like, they find something iconic and visually stimulating, and then combine that with their classical training and all these sorts of things. You know, that's what I think, that's what we all have to do. It's almost like pulling a dream out of your head and making it tangible.
That's a good way to put it.
And I think Bill's definitely one of those guys who does that with ease. So that came about, I was talking to George Pratt on Instagram, just messaging him and admiring his work, and I asked him a little bit about his techniques and things, because I'm always curious about how people work and their methods and things. And he says, well, you should look into the Illustration Academy in Kansas. And he goes, you know, we teach a class there in June. So I did. I looked into it. I remembered him mentioning that. I thought it was so nice of him to get back to me. And he mentioned that. And I looked it up, and there's Bill's name on there. He's one of the guys teaching down there. And I went in June to Kansas City in Missouri. And just did so there's a four-week program, four separate weeks, and I just did the first week, but I overlapped a little bit into week two. I stayed a little longer, and I chose that first thing basically because of the roster of talent that was available to learn from. There was the late Mark English, who I got to work with a little bit and meet, and he's like a golden age illustrator, that guy. He was kind of a living Norman Rockwell, and he just sadly passed away. And his son, it was him and his son that kind of started this program up, the Illustration Academy in Kansas. Just a phenomenal teaching environment. You just spend like all day in this room, and the artists are there, and you can go up and talk to them. They bring their original stuff. You work alongside. They do demos. They explain their techniques. You do life drawing. I did about 54 pieces of art, I think, that week. And I was there in the studio about 17 hours a day. But it wasn't even about what I produced. It was just, I wrote tons of notes. I was just taking in everything, learning as much as I could. But, I mean, I got to go to lunch with George Pratt and Bill and John and another fellow, Gary Kelly, another brilliant, brilliant illustrator. So these are top-notch illustrators that are at this program. So I'm going to go back again this June and say hi to Bill again. I said hi in New York, and you remember me, because the guy's brilliant. Brilliant memory on him. I like to tell people this one story when I was in Kansas, and Bill was critiquing. So they did this portfolio day on the Monday, so whatever you did the week before, your final piece, they put it up on easels. You do about, say, six at a time, and all the students are there and teachers are there. So it's kind of like the following week's teachers and students would look at the previous week's work, and they would look at it and analyze it and talk about it. Bill would glance at them all, and then he sat down behind the canvases and sit in his chair, and he kind of like sort of laying back and thinking. And everyone else was kind of had their nose up to the pieces and were analyzing, critiquing from there. But Bill, just from those glances at the works, like he would sit back in his chair, not looking, he was behind the works, and he was critiquing from there, like from behind, sitting in his chair, just from memory, like, you know, that octagon shape, you know, maybe if it was a warmer red, you know, against this blue that you have there on the left. Like, he was remembering all the details just from a glance like that. I don't know if you'd be embarrassed me saying something like that about him, talking about him, but, I mean, like, you could just see the sharp, sharp mind on him, and just this energy and this childlike enthusiasm, he loved it, too. Like, whenever another artist was doing a demo, he was right up front and asking questions and excited.
So you didn't come across like someone who, I'm Bill Sienkiewicz.
Not at all, no.
You know what I've done, and he was still excited to learn.
Yeah, and that was the beauty of this place, too. Everyone who walked in that door, they left their egos behind. It was just, we're all there to share our knowledge, and I kind of have that belief, too. Like, if you've been passed, like, you don't do this out of a vacuum. Like, you've been passed down information, and then you accumulate that with your own experience. I almost think it's an artistry. If you have something valuable like that, knowledge that's valuable to the world, I mean, share it. I mean, I think it's almost your obligation to share that with the up-and-coming generation.
Well, I think the people, I've listened to certain interviews with scientists and the like, where they'll say the thing that separates us from the animal kingdom, with all the similarities that we may find from time to time, is that we pass on knowledge.
Yeah.
We take what we learn, and when we're gone, the next generation can take what you've learned and keep it going. That doesn't happen in any other species than human beings. So we've learned. You may learn how to make fire. You teach your son, and
right
now everybody to history. Like, that's what makes us, gives us that human touch, right? So for him, for these guys to be in that room and to share all of these things, it's. I'm working the trade, so like I've worked with older men who get you to do the work, but they don't want to tell you why.
Yeah.
Or the reason, but because they're scared of you taking their job. Whereas in this actual trade, this application, everyone's saying, here's how we can make it better. Because really, we're translating things for people to find meaning.
Yes. And we touched on that earlier, the industry, how supportive everybody is. And I think to be in this industry, I think you have to have a love of the medium, or you're probably hating your life. I mean, you have to love this medium, and if you do, you probably want to see, a higher quality medium out there. You want to have new stories to read that look good and are, better stories than you've read before. I mean, we all want, we want better movies, better books, better comics. And I think there's that, too. There's this camaraderie. Like, there's a bit of friendly competition, but I think and I'm sure there's politics and nasty stuff going on just like any other industry, but I've never been in a industry like this warm and accepting and supportive. I found it, it's just been lovely. Like, everybody I get to meet, all these, they say never meet your heroes, but every hero I've met, you know, has been this warm, genuine, caring, giving kind of person.
That's good.
Yeah, and it makes me feel good, you know, that that's out there. Bill could have come in there, you know, I want 10 grand an hour, you know, like.
Sure.
But he's not like that, right?
The name itself would draw people to come to the course.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
But he came there because of, you know, Mark English. He came there because of Gary Kelly. And so he still has his heroes too, right? And you find that out. You look at the people you love, and then you look at who influenced them, and then who influenced them. And you can learn so much by doing that. That was one of the finer points they taught us there too.
So what did he think of your work when he critiqued it?
Honestly, like, I kind of did this thing. I was trying to get a portfolio interview with him. I tried to set that up, and he agreed to do it. And it was just, there was a lot going on. It was totally fine, because I wasn't even all that. I didn't need necessarily to show him my work. I may do that in the future, and I emailed him some stuff. But I ended up, you know, they needed a lunch break. I ended up joining them for lunch, which was like, and we weren't really talking about art so much, but it was just, I'm just like, man, I'm sitting here having lunch with Bill and John English and Gary Kelly and George Pratt, you know? I think I was the only student in the class that had that.
Did you still feel like that starstruck, or that, did you fan out a little bit? Or?
I did a little. I mean, and I didn't really talk to him too much. I'll finish this point before. So what I did, instead of having that portfolio thing, I ended up, he was coming back on Sunday, so he apologized that we didn't get to it. Like, he doesn't forget, like, and it wasn't, he wanted to make sure he got to everybody who wanted to see him. Not all the students knew who he was. They weren't all comic fans. Some of them were right out of high school, and they don't know. But the few of us who did were just like a little bit, you know, our tongues hit the floor when he came in. So he came in, we did life drawing on a Thursday night, and it's the middle of the class, and it's later in the evening. I was sitting down drawing, and Bill comes in, and it's just like, you know, it's almost like a rock star has walked into the room in a sense. But again, his ego wasn't there. He was just a friendly guy. He was saying hi to his buddies. He loved the environment and his friends, and he came to draw. I mean, so he ended up sitting two seats across from me, like on to my right, and it was his turn to get up the next pose. They said, Bill, why don't you pose the model, you know, lighter how you want, whatever. He says, okay. So he was up doing that, and the girl beside me was like, you know, who is he? And I so I go, oh, you don't know Bill? Okay. So I showed her a whole bunch of work on my phone and described his bio really quick, and then she says, you know, I can't sit here anymore. I'm too nervous. I don't want to sit next to it. Like, so will you switch with me? And I said, well, okay, I'll switch with you. So I ended up doing some life drawing sitting next to Bill Sienkiewicz. So I said my first words, and basically it was just like, you know, it's an honor to be able to draw next to you. This is kind of a dream of mine, but I'm a little intimidated. And he's like, ah, I'm sure you're killing it, man. You know, like, just, you know, put you at ease. And I didn't look over at what he did when he was working. I have that ability. I can, like, kind of just tune into what I'm doing. When I'm doing art, I can do that. So I just did the piece, and then I looked at them after, and it was interesting to see them side by side. If you're on my artwork of Casey Parsons' page on Facebook, you can see pictures of me drawing next to him, and the piece is how they turned out. Anyhow, so I was nervous for the first couple of days, but then, so by Sunday, he came in with a portfolio just rammed full of original art that he had. And he was coming just to, like, if anyone wanted to see it. So, of course, I sat next to him for about 3 hours going over his work and asking him a million questions and, you know, putting my nose right up to it, holding some, taking, you know, close-up photos. Because he would just, oh, yeah, I just dumped polyurethane on this drawing just to kind of see what it would do. You know, he kind of laughed, like, there was nothing sort of precious, like, he was okay to destroy his stuff, and it was amazing to see the original work, like, just, like that, it was just a priceless portfolio I had under some. So by that time, by Sunday, I was okay, I could talk to him, and I just, like, he was just such a regular guy in a way. Brilliant guy, but, you know, made you feel comfortable, welcome.
So what did that... I always ask this to artists, because I find that artists, they always like everybody else's stuff, but they often don't like their own. That seems to be the trend that I've seen. Even though you guys know that you can draw well and people celebrate your work, there's always that, man, you killed that. That looks so good. I wish I did that. What did that do for your confidence, having been in a room with all these people who were, you know, your heroes, as you said, and now... in a way they're your peers, like you're going to lunch with them and they're respecting your work just as much as you respect theirs in a way.
I don't think I want to come across as immodest or modest. I mean, like an honest opinion, I felt like I almost felt at home. I felt like I could be teaching with these guys. I didn't feel up to their level, but I felt like, you know, maybe in a couple of years or down the road it would be nice to... the environment was so nice. I felt like these are my kindred spirits in a way. Mm-hmm. These are my brothers, you know. I was the happiest I think I was all year almost, you know, aside from maybe a couple times, but I was so happy there. I went in there, I didn't want to go in there like I already know about art, you know. I tried to go in there and just, I'm going to do what they're proposing and learn as much as I possibly can. Like, just go in there and feed, you know, like be a glutton for whatever they're dishing out.
Yeah.
I kind of went in with that sort of frame of mind. Like, I'm going to go in like a clean slate. I'm going to show them what I can do. And I think, you know, they noticed, but so on one hand...
You didn't go there to sell yourself. You went there to learn.
No, not at all. No.
But in the process, I mean, making... When you're an artist of any kind, whether it's music or writing or drawing, whatever it might be, it's a lonely process. What's in your mind, you're trying to bring it out, whether it's in the words or melody, whatever it might be. You're trying, like you said, your dream, you're trying to bring it out.
Right.
And it's a very lonely process. And you always wonder, going about it the right way, even though I know how to do it and can get it done? Is this other people's experiences too? Do some people struggle where I struggle? Do some people have that epiphany moment the way I do? Like, it's always nice, like you said, to have that kindred moment with somebody.
Yeah. There's a lot there I could touch upon. I don't know if you ever feel like you're doing it the right way. I think you kind of...
No, never.
You get an idea in mind, and then you try and bring that to life. But then at some point, I find the art tells you what it needs to be.
Yes.
And then you got to kind of go with it. Like, it'll tell you, I'm not doing this, I'm going to do this. And you go, oh, I guess. Otherwise, you're just going to be struggling and fighting the thing. But that's kind of part of the fun of it, because... that's where you grow, that's where you discover, you learn, you know, unexpected surprises happen, and the drawing is usually right. Like, it's usually, it tells you what it needs to be.
Yeah. You gotta let it tell you.
Yeah, but I never feel like I'm doing the right thing. I mean, you almost always feel like an imposter, like, who am I to be? You know, we joke about that a lot. I mean, me and my friends, like, you know, this imposter syndrome. Some feel it more than others, I guess, but sometimes I feel that way, especially, like, you know, I'm emulating Jason Sean Alexander, like I said, so if I'm spraying ink with a toothbrush, I kind of feel like it's almost like I've just taken his thing in a way, you know, but in a way I don't worry about it too much. I'm not drawing the way he does. I'm doing my own thing. It's a tool. It's like, I'm going to use a pen nib even though the other guy's using the pen nib. It doesn't mean, you know, we're doing the same. It's just, they're all tools.
Yeah, well, how many people draw comic books and it's like the pencil stage, right? Everyone uses a pencil.
Yeah.
So you're not stealing it. But I think from...
it's disappearing a little, but...
Yeah, it is. But people can pick out your pieces. When they've seen Casey Barson's pieces, they can tell that it's you.
I appreciate that. And I only started hearing that the past year or so, where... even though everything looks different, it's yours. You know, I can tell it's yours. Because I always feel like, wow, I did that totally, you know, that's not really how I work. This is so different. You know, I get those kind of feelings. And I'm still experimenting. I'm still having fun. And I still have a long way to go, a lot to learn, a lot of things I want to try. The thing you were saying earlier, too, sorry, I'm kind of drawing a blank. I was going back to the point you were talking about of working on a piece of work.
When you have that process, I don't know if it's the process of am I doing it right? Do other people experience the same thing as me? I don't know if that was the point.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, I think it's always sort of an act of self-discovery.
Yeah.
You were saying it was a lonely thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. I mean, it almost has to be. There's like this idea of isolation where you're really internalizing things and then you're trying to bring your insides out onto the page. I mean, you've got ideas, you've got feelings, and art is about the only thing that can articulate feeling. I mean, music is close to that. Music deals in time and, you know, and art kind of deals in motion in a sense. Motion, like they're both kind of, they're cousins of each other. Yeah, I mean, you never know if you're doing the right thing. You never know if it's going to, if people are, like, some, I've done pieces this year, too. I was even doing the top nine thing everybody does on Instagram. And the top nine that came up on my, I'm like, really? Like, these nine? Like, why? Like, some I understood. Okay, yeah, I shook hands with Todd McFarlane. I understand that being a popular picture, you know, on the, whatever. And the Baby Yoda was a popular thing. But there was a couple on there. I'm like, why is that? This was just like a quick sketch. Like, I did better pieces than this. Like, you know, the Joker head wasn't in there. And that was a, you know, that was one of my best pieces. Yeah. And my Little Bird cover, which I was very proud of. And I thought that was a strong piece, but it wasn't in the top nine, which I found strange. And I think Instagram is just one of those things. It's such a quick, bite-sized thing, and people are just scrolling quick and liking, whatever. And they got to recognize something they know in order to do that. And it's got to be hashtag right, and I'm not great at all that.
Me neither. There's a time of day to post. I'm on Instagram and I can't get any more followers, or I don't care to anymore, because there was a time where I'm like, I gotta build up, because followers is currency, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, forget it. But then when I was looking into,
but you had to do that like years ago to get this, the, you know, just, to get that number up there.
Yeah. So I've never been good at it. Some people can within a month get 1,000 followers. I have no idea. There's a way to do it, a time of day to post, and all this nonsense hashtagging, like you said. So yeah, I don't get that.
You got
either
Batman, cats, boobs, you know, that'll get your numbers up.
That's right. Big butts.
Yeah,
that'll do it.
So that's you know,
yeah,
I don't want to play that game, like, just for, that's not really why I'm in it either. Like, I want to reach as many people as I can with, hopefully I have something to say when I do make a piece. Hopefully it resonates with someone, and I get good feedback, and it makes me happy. So just want to keep doing that. I mean, reach as many people. That's the beauty of the printed medium, too. You can, as opposed to a painting up on a wall in a gallery, you know, I mean, friends, I have a gallery show coming up, but I don't know how many people I know that are going to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to get likes on Instagram. But, you know, it might touch that one person, or someone may buy it and goes into their home and never to be seen again by anyone. And,
well, I think that's the point, right? When you make art, it's, you can either be doing it to appeal to the masses and not really make anything that you like, or you could be following a passion and you're gonna really affect the people who get it. They're gonna really be you'll change a life by it.
Yeah.
So I think that's the trade-off. Either way,
I don't know if I could claim that that it'll change a life.
Well,
but you never know. I mean, like, people do say things like, "Wow, that character really, you know, I emulated that character, idolized them, and it got me out of a real dark place." And you know, you do hear stories like that sometimes, and it's kind of surprising, but it's amazing what a little piece of art can do sometimes.
Well, that's why people get it tattooed on their bodies, right?
Yeah, I find that kind of nuts too.
But it happens.
But it happens a lot at the con. You know, you get that little kid coming around, and of course they're new to everything, and it's just this magical world now. Like, what is all this stuff? And you give them a drawing, you know, or you give them a little print, and it just, like, they light up, and you feel like you just made this fan for life. Like, they're now going to read comics, where before that day, you know, they might never have...
It's the rabbit hole effect, right?
Yeah.
You draw that picture of the Flash that makes them love the Flash, and now they're reading... They end up, you know, down a rabbit hole that they never thought that they'd be down.
So in some small way, I mean... It just seems kind of huge to say, like, you're changing lives. Like, it just seems a bit big, but... Because I think we're in an entertainment industry, in a way. Like, you're there to... You know, people can kind of escape the drudgery of the day and the, some of the escapism a little bit, right?
Absolutely.
But I mean, as from an artist, from a creator standpoint, my life gets changed when I see something of high quality and then I want to figure out how it's done. And that'll change, you know, I adopt that experience. Like, I take that in and it gets filtered through and becomes a part of how I work. You know, I might take just a fraction of it, but it'll change things.
Yeah.
You know? And there's always those pieces that stand out and artists that stand out. I think we all have that. There's always our favorites. Everyone's got different favorites.
Yeah.
And things that touch them. And you just read that thing, a rainy day at the right time of your life, and it stuck with you. And it means something. It's kind of neat if you can have that effect. And I love to see my stuff, you know, on people's shelves or in a bookstore on a shelf.
It'll happen.
I know it might be there after I'm gone.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
And it's a really cool thing.
So we've been talking for a bit, but we haven't even gotten into a little bit of the history of Casey Parsons.
Oh,
where you grew up? Tell us a little bit about that come up in wherever town you were from.
The skeletons.
Yeah, let's go into the closet, dude. This is your life. This is therapy time now.
Oh boy. The boring part.
Yeah.
Okay. I grew up in Stony Creek. It's now amalgamated into Hamilton, Ontario. I grew up during the wars. That would be the Star Wars.
They have just ended.
Yeah, they just ended. They ended, but they're ongoing.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of had a basically normal childhood in a way. I mean, I was an oddball, but I was always drawing. Even about 2 years old, I mean, by three, I knew for sure I wanted to be an artist. Like, that was
really?
It. Oh, yeah.
That's
I knew
so
by
cool.
3 years old. I was trying to figure out, I was drawing, you know, I draw in the car when my mom was driving, and I bring a little, she was great by giving me blank paper all the time and pens and pencils. And so I was drawing, I noticed the streetlights were getting smaller the farther away they were. I was trying to figure out why, you know, what that was going. I was drawing the streetlights in perspective. And I remember that. I don't have the drawing anymore, but I remember doing that. And just this whole thing of... And I was just kind of... just by nature, a loner sort of kid. I like sitting by myself and drawing, just having that smell of a freshly sharpened pencil and blank paper. But I was always drawing. I got into comics. I got into Incredible Hulk when I was very young and collected that. And that stuck with me all through high school. I ended up working at a comic store, which I then later am a owner of. I'm a part owner at of a store in Stony Creek.
That's so cool.
And the store I worked at, we moved it, and our good friend Tom Lang passed away. If any of you ever had the pleasure to meet that guy, he's a brilliant guy. Ran just this wonderful little shop in Stony Creek, Comic One Books. And the store's, you know, been reopened in 2013, still in Stony Creek downtown. So we had a few partners, and and that kind of got me back into drawing comics. I mean, between 2013 and me getting out of high school, I went to Sheridan College, and that was the place to go to learn to draw and paint. So, and I made some lifelong friends out of there. Some of the teachers I still hang out with, brilliant people. I learned a ton off of them.
And you're part of a pretty great class, too.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people in my class now. It's been one of the wonderful things is started going to the conventions and starting seeing all my old classmates because a lot of them got into comics.
What do you think it was about that particular class? Were there a lot of artists in general who were into comics because it's, you know, an artistic medium? Or was it that class in particular that was special?
It's so strange because at the time we were told, you know, the medium's dying, don't get into comics, don't draw comics.
That's every year.
But we all wanted to. When we all sat at the coffee time across the street or something, we'd be sketching comic book characters. You know, that's a lot of us wanted to really be doing that. But I mean, I got self-conscious about it and turned off. And
how come?
I turned to fine art for a long time.
What made you turned off from it?
I think it was that fear. I mean, could I make a living? Do I know how to get into this thing? Am I good enough?
Yeah.
I mean, I was really enjoying like getting into oil painting and drawing and life drawing and drawing from nature and just. Because there's something really wonderful, but I still love doing it. I still do fine art. And to me, that's kind of like, I take that a little more seriously. There's even sort of a deeper self-discovery about that. It's almost a religion in a way when you do fine art.
Hmm.
It does kind of the same things.
Explain. That's interesting.
Well, one, you learn a lot about yourself. So you learn your tendencies and you learn about your own prejudice in a sense, and how to let go of that. You learn a new way of seeing. It gives you a different sense of wonder about things. It's hard to explain. I mean, it even helps you in one way. You're coping with all the big ideas, life and death and, you know, the meaning of stuff, and you're trying to figure out what your emotions are and what they mean and your response to the world around you. There's always that energy between you and the subject matter that you're trying to put out, make it a real 3D thing, like you sculpt it or paint it or draw it, where other people can then share that experience. It's a communication tool. But you're communicating emotion, right? You're trying to put somebody else in your head and have them experience that experience and feel and move around inside the work. And I'm talking about traditional, you know, like doing a realistic landscape or a portrait and trying to make that activated, lifelike, you know, feel three-dimensional, that illusion of life. I mean, it's all deception, but in a way it's... I feel like it's sometimes more real than reality.
Yeah, yeah. No, I
there's a lot of...
it sounds...
That's what could be a whole other discussion.
I talk about those type of things all the time. Like, I love that sort of digression or tangent when you talk about art and creating. Because I can't draw, but I do make music with a friend of mine. And it was something that I had a passion for as a kid that I put off because, again, it was that sort of,
yeah,
you get turned off by it, that imposter syndrome kicks in. But that love of the art and appreciation for expression is always there.
Yeah.
And I find that I find more meaning and understanding in the world around me by having to create, because you tap into a... It's almost like as much as you wrote it or as much as you drew it, it was always there. It was just a matter of you finding it.
Yeah.
It takes a certain amount of skill and practice and all of those type of things to be able to do it, but it isn't just you.
Right. And that never ends.
Yeah.
And I find like fine art kind of begins in music and that where words fail in a sense.
Yeah.
Where when you go back to illustration and comic books, I mean, you're combining images and words. So it's illustration to me. It's more, I don't want to say it's lesser or anything, but it's a more commercial, it's a different medium, it's an entertainment communication medium, but I still see it as like a higher art form, and I think that comes from the overall storytelling. The quality is there in the storytelling. Yeah, fine art was always something a little bit... I treat it much more serious. Like it's something like a little deeper, a little more... I use kind of my entire brain and heart when I'm doing fine art. So I find illustration, I don't have to take it as serious. I can have a bit more fun with it. I'm not as precious with it. And sometimes you just got to get a thing done and move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Which I hate. So I don't like sacrificing quality ever.
But it's also a different... It's also, again, you're translating something differently.
Yes,
and,
definitely.
And it doesn't take away from the value of it, of what it's going to mean in regards to a story.
Right.
It's just that, like you said, I got to get from this moment of a character doing something to there. Whereas with the fine art, that one piece, it's got to
yeah.
give all kinds of emotion without there being all of that paneling that you get to have with a comic.
To me, like, the only story when I'm doing with fine art, it's just like, this is me, this is you, this is the experience, this feels like this.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no real, it's not necessarily a story, it's like you're trying to take this moment and activate it, you know, make it alive, capture that fraction of life and hold on to it, you know, make it eternal. And I think music does that too.
Well, a lot of times me and my friend have had this discussion where he says the music won't be as good unless we have the right picture to accompany it. When we know what the picture is, then we can make the music to it. That's his strategy. So we
just something to have in your mind.
Yeah. So he had a visual of a Charlie Brown. He didn't know the reference. I knew the reference, but it was Lando Calrissian and Charlie Brown in that style. So Lando and his partner, the guy in Empire Strikes Back that follows him around with the little headpiece. I don't know the character's name. He's like kind of cybernetic. Anyways, it's Charlie and Franklin dressed up in Star Wars cosplay in a way.
Okay.
So he started with that, and he sent it to me to give to Shane. Can you do a riff of this as the album cover?
Okay.
And based off of what that looked like, he chose the music and chose everything else to go with it. And a lot of times when you look at a picture, if you have the right music accompanying what you're looking at, it will translate what the actual expression of it should be, I think.
So we're getting deep here, folks. You got to tune in and turn the volume up a little. Yeah, I feel, and there's a funny thing, you can never be in another person's head or know what they're feeling or seeing. I almost feel like everyone sees color just slightly differently.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and their feelings are very similar, but a little different for everyone, right? And some have bigger feeling or more external feeling, and I'm very internalized. You never see strong reactions out of me anymore. I'm too calloused and broken. But that's kind of the interesting what you're saying about music and art. You know, there's something that my friend I mentioned earlier, Tom Lang, late Tom Lang, used to say, like, you know, when you listen to Mozart or something, it's like they're almost plucking the right notes. Like, those strings are already in you and those notes are already there, and like they were just able to kind of reach in and pluck them for you.
Yeah.
So it's like this innate thing, and it's like the best stuff, the clearest stuff like that becomes iconic, and you create this sort of sense of there's a community there. There's like you're outside of yourself, or we're all connected. You see that we're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a strength in that connectivity, an energy in that connectivity of feeling. See what I mean?
Yeah, no, completely. And when you think of some of the, you know, some of our favorite music or classic albums, everybody has a different one, but they quickly resonate to the artwork that accompanies it. Like when you think, I don't know what kind of music you like particularly, but if you think of Led Zeppelin 4,
yeah,
you can automatically see the picture. And if that, it goes together so well, even though sometimes the music is different from an old man carrying sticks on his back, you think, what does that have to do with Black Dog? But
right.
No other album cover will suffice to go with that album.
Right.
And I think when they accompany each other well, it's magic.
It's hard to know, right? Like, because we've already seen it and experienced it, it'd be hard to separate the two now. It's like we were talking about Christopher Reeve being Superman. It's hard to not picture, for me even, like, you grow up with that, it's hard not to picture Christopher Reeve as Superman. I thought Cavill did a great job and whatever, but experiences like that, it's hard to then go back and say, like, I can't imagine that being any different than what it was. It just seemed so perfect for what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's hard to explain what that is, where that, there's a bit of magic to it almost, like, why is that like that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to pinpoint. But it's like if all the feelings are in sync, you get this kind of like wicked unity between like minds. And
yeah,
I mean, that's
it's hard for people who don't necessarily, like, some people can go into an art gallery and be like, yeah, whatever, it's a painting. But when you get the people who kind of understand the emotion or find meaning in what's created from imagination, right, there's something different there. Not everyone has it, but when you have it, it's very special.
Right. And I believe in our, and I love our uniqueness as people, but I do believe there's very, very strong connections and similarities too. They talk about that every kid around the world goes na 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 na, that that one musical line. Without, I mean, these could be, you know, from a tribe deep in South America that has never been exposed to another culture would do that. You know, all the way around the world, every culture has that same thing, and you got to go, why? You know? Like, how is that an innate thing? It's part of our biology somehow, or, you know, it's just a sound resonating from the universe through us, you know, comes out.
Yeah.
Like, what is that, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So I think there's iconic visual things that do the same thing.
Yeah.
Like the Mona Lisa is a weird painting, you know? It's a bizarre looking woman with no eyebrows. I mean, like...
Yeah.
And the background, like... Both sides are on two different levels, but somehow it's like a perfect portrait. It works so well, and it just becomes this thing where it's done extremely well, or, you know, it's masterful and iconic. Like it's just you've got this icon and just a masterful built thing, creation there.
It's hard to explain.
It is hard to explain.
Can't explain it. Yeah. That's what's beautiful about the art, right?
But there's just those certain things, these magical things that stick in your mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I hope to make some of those this year.
That's my
resolution for 2020.
What made you fall in love with comics again? Not that you ever fell out of it, but what made you want to draw and do all of that? You said the comic shop.
Yeah.
Owning it.
That's right. And that was kind of something that just kind of happened. It wasn't really planned. So our friend passed away, and it was kind of our safe place to go. And, you know, he was a good friend of mine. I love comics. We would visit him. I wasn't collecting so much at the time, at that point. Just the odd thing here and there, like certain artists I really liked and some obscure guys and writers and artists. But, yeah, opening that shop up, I got reintroduced, and my partner introduced me to guys I was unfamiliar with, because I knew a lot of comics when I worked there in the 90s about the stuff going on currently, but I didn't, you know, at the time, but not until 2013 did I discover guys like Wally Wood and Al Williamson, and, you know, learn that Hal Foster was Canadian, and just start really diving into, like, that world and who influenced them, and, you know, really getting back into, like, these illustrators, and, you know, you're in that store and you're surrounded by it, and you get kind of caught up in that. There's something kind of wonderful and fun and addictive about it.
Mm-hmm. And it never ends either.
It doesn't end.
It's the beautiful and most frustrating part of it, because, like you said, now we live in an age, and you probably realize this even more having worked in a comic shop, everything's coming back, everything's being reprinted, stuff that was very hard to get, or,
yes,
you know, like, that was of a bygone era. If you find it, you're lucky. The best thing you can maybe do is get a PDF file of it, but now everything is coming back. Things that you never thought you were going to be able to read.
One is Moonshadow.
I just bought that.
It was like 25 year out of print book.
Yeah, you know. I'm a big J.M. DeMatteis fan, so I had never read it.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of saving that read. It's the one book that
it's
I have
on epic,
this.
Just an epic tomb, like a massive accomplishment.
Yeah, and he's a guy who I can talk to endlessly about the same things we're talking about now, because he's such a... There is that dream aspect to his writing.
Right.
And I can't wait to read that book. I'm saving it. It's one of those ones I know I'm going to read, but I wanted to buy it before it was gone again.
It's fun. It's like, once you start reading it, it's, again, it's one of those things that resonates. It's like you already know the story almost while you're reading it. And you fall into it very easily. It's like, these are all characters I know I'm familiar with somehow, even though I haven't met them before.
Right.
And there are some archetypes, like a lot of archetypes, and it's pulling on a lot of fairy tales and things, so it does resonate a lot of that.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful, magical work.
Now, you said you were in England for a while.
Yes.
As a teacher.
That's right.
What was that experience like living in England?
Good memory, I'm a major. Yeah. Yeah, that was totally different. This is me. I was on a couple of different goals there, and one was to give myself my own. They used to do, artists back in the day used to kind of do their own European tour, like the Great Tour.
Yeah.
And you would go around Europe and see the galleries and study fine art, you know, in the best places and learn right from the originals. So I wanted to do that. I kind of gave myself my own tour. So that was part of the goal of getting over there. Teaching came about. It was just one of those things like, how do I make a living? What do I do with my life? Fine art was a very difficult world to try and make a living in. And I'm not super flexible when it comes to fine art. I'm kind of snobbish and stubborn.
Because you love it so much, though. That's probably why.
Yeah, and I'm doing this traditional stuff, and it can be a hard sell now. And I mean, when you look at the stuff that people are buying and what they're into in the art market and how corrupt it all is and how it's just about, you know, Sotheby's art auction and these crazy things, you know, everyone just heard about, like, the banana taped on the wall and that kind of stuff, you know, and the Barnett Newman stripe, you know, selling for, or Canada buying that for a silly amount of money. That was controversial at the time. And I got kind of turned off by those things. And it just wasn't the world I imagine being a part of. I thought, you know, there was still room for traditional artists, and there sort of is. And I think it's coming back a little bit now, but it was a tough go. And I thought, well, I have a lot to offer. I wanted, you know, teaching is kind of always in the back of my brain. It's not, I don't have that great desire. Like, I don't see teaching as my first and foremost thing. Like, making art is the thing. But I thought, like, if I can teach it, you know, and I thought if I have the degree, it's like, it sounds awful, but something to fall back on. It's not a great way to look at it. And I realized England was the place that had the jobs. That's why I went to England, too. It was just, there was work over there. And everything just kind of clicked. It was just, it was work, and like, wow, all these galleries are out there. I could travel. I could finally see the world and see Europe, and all the galleries in England are free, which is really nice.
Wow, that's cool.
It was amazing. I lived in them. Every other day, you'd see me at a gallery, at least. I wrote a lot based on what I saw and studied paintings over and over. Yeah, and then I did that for about a year, and then I went back for about a half year again with a friend, and I did some private teaching around Toronto and Burlington as well, and then I kind of got out of it. Like, I just, it was stressful, and I knew it wasn't, like, I wasn't, it's hard. There was a lot of reasons. There was politics, there was, I didn't get to teach the way I really wanted to teach. Like, you're a bit controlled by the curriculum and
even in England,
the way things are. Even in England, yeah. It's not very different. England is a little more modeled on the American way of doing things, but there's a stronger, I think, education system in England.
And you were teaching all kinds of stuff, right?
You weren't
an art teacher. You were everything.
I tried to do it to teach art. I had a junior to intermediate senior qualifications. But I ended up teaching even, like, preschoolers. And I taught, like, when I first went over, I was at a middle school, and I had hundreds and hundreds of kids. Like, I was teaching 23 classes a week, and eight of them were religion, like, world religions.
What was that like? That interests me, because I love learning about...
I actually enjoyed that. I mean, because I love learning and reading, and it was kind of almost a way of educating myself by... When you have to teach it to somebody, you learn things
yourself.
Yeah. So,
were they teaching it from any sort of a slant, or was it just like,
no,
these are what all the religions on the world?
Yeah, because you're as an educator, you don't indoctrinate, right? You're not saying you have to believe this. You can't do that. And we had, you know, there were students from all different walks of life there, and backgrounds and religions.
England,
in the classroom.
England isn't just English-born people. You got a lot of...
Right, and you have, for instance, Jehovah's Witness in the classroom. And their religion says they're not really supposed to talk about other religions or listen or whatever. So, and I had a hard time with, there was a couple of nice young girls, and I'm saying, like, I'm not telling you what to believe. This is just what's out there. This is just information that's out in the world. Like, this is what other people are doing and believing in, and, you know, this is just something, like, you can treat it as stories or however you like. Like, I'm not asking you to believe any of this. This is just a version of one culture's belief, you know, at a time. Like, I was teaching all different, like, creation myths and things like that. And it was actually, I enjoyed that. I actually enjoyed teaching art maybe the least. And that was because I'm so close to it and so emotionally attached. And if you're not able to impart what you believe, communicate the way you want to, it's like the hands tied behind my back, you know. Like, it was really uncomfortable. So I actually enjoyed teaching things like geography and English, even though I wouldn't have enjoyed those subjects in school when I was young, but I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, how it's presented to you and when you're forced to learn as opposed to learning on your own terms is very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
The secret was just staying ahead of the kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had to learn a lot really quickly. Like, I was teaching English history, right? So I had to go back, and I did a huge thing on the Battle of Hastings and, you know, things like that. So it was a lot of fun, though. I mean, I learned quite a bit. And I appreciate that history. It was rich and full and exciting.
Yeah, I bet. I'm at a point in life where I often say to people, I don't know anything. That's why I want to keep getting information.
Good place to start.
Because sometimes my wife will, you know, she'll always ask me questions and I have no idea. But she asks me, like, why are you asking? She's like, well, you always seem to have an answer. You seem so smart. And I'm like, I'm not smart. Really, I don't know anything is where I start from, because there's always going to be something for you to learn from somebody.
Right.
Even when you think that you've got it all figured out, once you encounter that person and they're not willing to take in what else is out there, do you really know what you think you know? Do you know what I mean? It becomes that echo chamber of you're just constantly reinforcing what you already know, but you don't really know much.
I, you know, and I still kind of feel the way you do, and I felt it more when I was a young man like you. but, yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you're never going to be able to get all the information that's out there. And we're never going to know all that. There's so much more unknown than known.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is part of the exciting thing, too.
Absolutely.
Like, I love astronomy for that reason. But there's never too late to start either. I mean, and comics are a good place to start, even. To learn a lot out of comics.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know what? I tell people all the time when they ask me, like, my stance on things or my universal view on stuff sometimes, and I've read a lot in my life. You know, I've read lots of the Bible and all those type of things, but there's something about the imagination of even a Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
And how he was envisioning the universe and telling these myths. There's something about it that resonated with me.
Yeah.
Even though I haven't read a lot of his comics, but what came out of his mind and what is constantly being retouched by people like Walt Simonson and John Burns and, you know, even Tom King recently with Mr. Miracle.
Yeah.
The Thor mythology.
He's a great writer as well, yeah.
Just the Celestials and Eternals in the Marvel Universe, just, I don't get it all, but for some reason it makes sense to me.
I think you would really like the works of Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
And if you're not up for reading, there's a good interview online. You can see it on YouTube. An interview with Bill Moyer. I think it's called The Power of Myth.
There's a Netflix documentary, Myths and
Monsters. There is, about him, yeah.
That was good,
yep.
Too.
But he's excellent. And I think Jack Kirby was kind of on that realm, like, realizing you know, the Bible doesn't totally make sense anymore. Like, we're a different species now, almost. Like, we've come a long way. And it's like we're almost ready for that story to be retold, or we're ready for new mythologies. I'm not trying to slander any beliefs or religions here. I'm just saying.
You're the religion teacher, don't worry.
I'm just trying to put that disclaimer in there. I don't want any death threats or anything. But I think that's part of what Jack Kirby was realizing. It's like we're ready for like kind of a new mythology. Like we need these things to believe in. We need these things to guide us. And the mythologies were there. The stories were there as an example of how to live a better life and how to understand our lives. They were leading us on the right path.
Storytelling is the key to every different society. It marks not just it doesn't just tell history, but it also, with like in watching that documentary, they were discussing Robin Hood and how Robin Hood took different forms of a mythological figure depending on who was in power at the time, because that story was being told to different societies of England, you know, so the citizens of a certain queen or king or whoever was in power, they kind of altered the story of Robin Hood to represent what needed to be represented at that time. These stories are so important to how we proceed as a culture, and they're always being touched a little bit here and there, whether we like to think of that or not. We want to sometimes hold things precious, but they do get tweaked a little bit depending on the time of history we're in.
So even these little, funny little comic book stories,
100%,
they're teaching you things and you don't even realize you're learning or taking that in.
I say that all the time.
Yeah, they're examples of, or sometimes symbolic of things, you know, because it's not necessarily realistic, and that's okay, but it's there to help get the point across. And I don't think like they should all be moral tales or anything. I don't
know.
It doesn't have to be a message, but yeah, good stories, I think, are. You can learn something from them.
Well, that's why the good ones live forever, right?
Yeah.
You'll remember them. You'll refer back. You'll read them again, and you'll learn something new from them. So, let's talk a little bit about Cauldron. You're one of the four main guys now on Cauldron. Originally, you weren't, but you became.
Yeah, I was there. I mean, I was there at the beginning, but I wasn't. It was funny. It was just so Sam Noir and Shane Heron and Ricky Lima, they had already discussed, I think kind of vaguely, but I think they were discussing this idea of trying to do their own anthology and maybe a horror anthology or something along those lines, like Supernatural or something like Heavy Metal. And it'd be short stories in a different format and things like that. And I think they were just looking at other anthologies being done, thinking like, you know, we could do something. I just there was kind of this, I'll get into that after, but at the same time, I just finished a couple of comics and I learned a lot from them. To me, it was a learning experience anyhow. And I was looking to, I didn't feel like I was working the way I should have worked. I was working the way I thought I should work. Mm-hmm. You know, what it was expected of me and not my true, you know, I wasn't
your true
being me.
Right.
Yeah. I was doing like, this is what comics, this is how they should be made, you know, and that's not the right approach. Like, you got to be you. And so I wanted to experiment. I wanted to do some short stories and I wanted to do some horror stuff. Just almost like to practice, like to get better and then go back into doing bigger stories, which I want to start doing this year now. I had done a variant cover for Shane's book, Morris.
That was the first thing of yours that I saw, I just have to say.
Yeah, a lot of people, that was the first thing that kind of like, who's this guy?
And I said to Shane, I'm like, oh, your book is going to be this good if that's the cover. Because it was beautiful. But go ahead.
Shane did a great job.
No, he did a great job.
I love Morris.
No, me too.
That's a great character.
Yeah, it really is.
Brilliant. I don't mean to suck up to Shane. He doesn't deserve it.
Shane can...
Yeah.
Just kidding, Shane.
We love you, buddy.
We love you so much.
Yeah, it just happened to be at the same time I discussed with those guys. Like, we kind of were starting to get to know each other then. And I've been introduced to Shane in the past, like before that, through another friend. Guy Josh Decker did a cover of one of Black Hole Hunters Club. Mm-hmm. I went to Sheridan with him, and we used to, like, you know, share places together and stuff, like living quarters when we were going through school. And so he introduced me to Shane, and then down the road I did that Morris cover, I guess. Shane probably saw my Blood Moon work and thought, oh, you know, here's another guy who might want to contribute something. And I don't think he was a fan of Blood Moon, really, but... So he didn't expect it, though. He didn't expect what I gave him. I was just starting to try and be more myself and be more painterly and, like, show people what I'm capable of, right? I was, like, just itching to get some work like that. So it was fun. It was exciting. It was a good project. It was a good, just, you know, kind of a fun idea. And, you know, he's lighting a cigar with that stick of dynamite, and you see the T-Rex in the background just exploding because he had already eaten a piece of dynamite. That was fun. So that kind of got me noticed with those guys, and, you know, I think we got along right away. And they were already talking about doing this Cauldron thing, and I immediately was interested. I mean, it just sounded like it was just this perfect thing. It was exactly what I was looking for. And it just felt like, yeah, and like we'd have total creative control. We'd publish it ourselves, you know, all that kind of thing. So I ended up getting heavily involved, even though really it was the three of them, it was their brainchild. I got heavily involved right from the outset. Mm-hmm. And on the second issue, they made me like a co-editor now, like co-publisher, co-editor. So I ended up doing the cover and doing the art for one of Ricky Lima's stories in the first issue. And then I colored Adam Gorham's cover on the second issue and did my own writing and art, retelling a Greek myth for the second issue. And then I've got a cover coming up on the third one, and I'm doing the art for Casey Pierce's story. And she's a wonderful writer, doing really well. Source Point Press, Nora, you know, she's got the movie option now. Yeah, she's doing great. So she's wonderful.
The third Cauldron is coming out in February, I've been told.
Yes.
In February. And then yeah, you guys are already working on the fourth one.
Yeah, we've had delays, but I mean, we're already underway on the fourth one.
Yeah.
So we're hoping the fourth one may come out pretty close on the heels of issue three. Like, we're still on track with the fourth one. It's just the third one got delayed for a couple of crazy reasons, but we had to kind of start from scratch one of the stories, and but we're still committed to putting out a quality product, so we'd rather have quality come out rather than rush it and get it out, you know, right when it's expected.
Right.
And we're still trying to figure that out too, like if we can do two books a year or three books a year, you know, because we'd like to push for that at some point, like have more books coming out consistently.
And there's enough events in Toronto, comic related events, where you can do these launches where a lot of
we'll
people
be at TCAF again this year.
Yeah,
Cauldron's going to have a table at TCAF, so that will likely be our launch for the fourth one. So hopefully, I have three and four there. I'm excited about it. I think the third issue is just killer. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, I saw some,
I just,
some
I'm
stuff
dying for
it.
People to get it. I'm sure they're dying to get it, too.
Yeah.
You know, and we hate we've made people wait this long, but it's going to be worth it. And like I say, we'd rather put out quality than just try and rush something or put out something. You know, we wanted to keep the same story, like the amount of pages, and we had to rejig some things. I did a couple extra pages, and I put a... some art at the beginning too on the credits page, which is different, which wasn't going to be there before. I think we've got a different pinup now and a whole new story going in there, so that's why the extra time has happened, and we want to give everyone the right amount of time to get it done properly, so everyone's going to be fully rewarded and still get their book. I'm just hoping no one's worried, and I'm sorry it didn't come out when we promised on the Kickstarter, but
you know. Well, it just gives us we're excited now because the fourth issue is going to be not too far behind it, right?
Yeah.
So that's
I think just those first few issues, it's hard. Like, because we really have to like have stories in the bank almost. We have to have things that are finished coming into us, and we are getting that now.
Yeah, you got to get it.
And this third issue is like where that kind of started. We had a story that was complete, submitted. So we're starting to get that now. We've got people like kind of all over, like in the States and everywhere, like wanting to be a part of this. And we were getting to be more selective about who gets in, and
that's good.
So we're keeping the quality right up there, which is nice. And we're sticking to our guns about what this thing should be. We don't want anyone taking over and changing it. We want to keep this cauldron. You know, I always see it as like it's almost like this entity that needed to come into being. We all felt it was like hovering over us. We had to like kind of pull it down out of the ether and publish this thing.
That's what it feels like, to be honest.
Yeah, it was just the right thing at the right time.
Yeah. When Shane used to tell me about it before the first one happened, I thought it was a cool idea. I said, yeah, you know, these guys can pull that together.
Yeah.
But then when you see it and you kind of get a sense of what it can be and the type of artists, I always say to all of you guys when I speak to you individually, like, if there's something special to it that will attract all levels of fandom. And all levels of talent. And it's a good breeding ground for guys to really showcase how good they can be. And then even people who are established talent to come down and do some sort of a passion project.
I believe that's true, yes. And we do showcase the art. I mean, it's one of the reasons we go with a bigger format.
Mm-hmm.
So we want the art to kind of take center stage. I'm pushing now not only to keep the art quality, like, higher and sort of try and get a little farther, like make it a little grittier, get away from the more cartoony things. So I really want like an adult, more adult, mature feel to the magazine. Like, we don't mind, I think it's more like for teenagers and up kind of our book. Like, we kind of alienate the little kids a bit.
But it is the cool book that kids can have and hide.
Yeah. Right. But you gotta hide it from your ma, you see? But yeah, I'm pushing now to kind of get the stories up to the level of the art. I want that, like, every issue we're trying to, okay, this was great, but what can we do better?
That's what it should be.
What was something we could have done better? Or, you know,
what we haven't done yet.
Yeah, and I think Cauldron's still finding its tone, its voice, its look, its feel. But I feel like, I think number 3 is knocking it out of the park. I think it's just,
it's the best of the
park. Hard without everyone being able to see it right now, you know, but yeah, I think they're going to love it.
Around the corner.
They're going to love it.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
It's coming.
A lot of great things from Cauldron are coming, 2020.
Awesome.
This is our year.
This is the year. So to wrap up, I want to ask you some rapid-fire questions, some
okay.
fun ones.
Okay.
I hear you're an outdoors kind of guy.
Yes.
So what animal best describes your personality?
I have two answers. Sometimes it would be the sloth, and other times probably something like I don't know, maybe an orangutan.
I like that.
Yeah.
The two very different spectrums there.
Yeah.
And speeds. Okay, why is Skinny Pop the best snack?
That had to do with me changing my diet up. So it was one of those few snacks that I could go back to over and over. Who doesn't love popcorn, right?
I love popcorn.
And I found it was a tasty snack, and it agreed with my stomach after getting off of dairy and a lot of other things. So, you know, I eat other snacks, but I appreciate the Skinny Pop and what they do. Yeah, it's hard to explain. I mean, that's to each of their own. But I'm a popcorn lover, and that goes back to being a movie lover too.
Yeah, I'm a popcorn lover too. So, speaking of movies,
keep your mitts out, Shane.
What book do you wish would be turned into a movie or a TV series now? Because TV series are almost better than movies, it seems.
Hmm. That's an excellent question. That's tough, eh? Like, it's hard. I'm not giving you a rapid-fire answer.
It's okay.
Because it's hard, right? You're like, things that work as books might not work as a comic. I think they usually can. It translates better than comics into movies.
It could be a comic book that hasn't turned into a movie yet. Any book.
Yeah. I mean, Shane's been talking about, I mean, I've seen, you know, he's been mentioning like Edgar Allan Poe. And I think there's, I don't think Lovecraft has quite been done right either. I think there's been some good adaptations, but I think there's Lovecraft short stories or, I mean, I love the darker stuff. I love the supernatural and psychological thriller type of books. I mean, even something like Kafka's Metamorphosis or something like that could be kind of fun if it was done right. It could be a real boring comic or it could be an exciting comic. I don't think I want to do that one. Yeah, I love kind of when you can... I think comics are very good at doing psychological thrills rather than, you know, make you jump out of your seat. I don't think they're as good to that. So I like the thrillers. I don't know if I could be very specific on one story, though. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. How about a movie? A book to a movie?
A book to a movie?
Yeah. Or a TV series.
Oh, yeah. No, I have trouble thinking that way.
I wouldn't mind seeing an Exo Manowar movie.
That would be interesting, yeah.
Because you got that Conan vibe mixed with a little bit of sci-fi.
Yeah.
That'd be cool to see.
What about something like Grendel?
Okay.
You know, that could be fun. I think maybe they could try the spirit again, but do it properly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm just kind of racking my brain now.
That's okay, to come back to it.
I think it'd be fun to take like a Frazetta painting and try and make a movie out of that. Kind of like a heavy metal used to try and make a story out of. They look at his paintings and then make a story based on the painting.
Yeah, that's
I think
a
it'd
cool
be fun
idea.
To like take a piece of art like that and make a movie out of it.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Like Death Dealer movie, you know, why not?
I was thinking that too. If you could take a picture and tell like even Mona Lisa, tell the Mona Lisa story.
Yeah.
Just off of the picture. Would that be possible? Would it be
so
accepted?
Many crazy myths and legends about that thing.
Right?
Yeah.
So you being a fine art person.
Okay.
If you could fit your whole life into one picture, what would it look like?
Like I'm choosing a historic piece of fine art now?
Well, to reflect your life.
That reflects my life.
What would it be if it was to be drawn? Not one that exists.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So, if you could fit your whole life into one picture.
Okay.
How would it look? What would be the...
Like what's going on in this picture?
Yeah, to describe Casey Parsons' life.
I think... I mean, it'd have to be a portrait, right? But, I mean, it's like what you put around in the portrait. So it'd probably be kind of a landscape. Kind of at dusk. There's probably a storm on the horizon, I would think. It's probably some strange... You know, maybe there's an owl in a tree. Something like that. I'm probably have a stack of books somewhere nearby. Maybe I'm holding a candle and then a glass of whiskey in the other hand.
I like it. I can see it. I can see it.
It's just an idea.
You should try it. I can see it.
Sounds silly and pretentious.
No, it doesn't. I could, all the things you describe...
But it's very me.
It's very... That's the point. Everything that... A little bit that you've told me today, I'm like, all of those things... I can kind of see why you would pick those things.
Yeah.
That's good. All right, last one.
Okay.
What's the perfect day in the life of Casey Parsons?
Wow. I think you have to have good company, good food, you know, see some great art. I like kind of a nice cultural location, like... Like being in the middle of Amsterdam or Paris or something, and you know, see a Rembrandt and then have your girl at your side, share a nice meal, maybe see a concert in the evening.
It's a good day.
Yeah. Probably recite some poetry while taking a walk in nature.
Oh, wow. I want to spend this day with you.
Yeah.
What's the concert? That's a PS question.
Well, it would likely be a fine production of, you know, Mozart's Don Giovanni or
You're very artsy.
Something like that. Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you, Casey.
I hope everyone enjoyed this. I had a fun time.
This was very enjoyable.
Yes.
We didn't follow any specific script, which was good. I had questions lined up, but we kind of made it go out.
I was completely unprepared.
No, and that's when the best conversation happens.
Yeah.
So, Cauldron, looking forward to anything else in 2020 that we should be on the lookout that you can tell us about. You're going to be at Toronto Comic Con?
Yes, I will be at Toronto Comic Con. I've got a lot of shows coming up, and some are still kind of being worked out, but my first one's going to be in Bologna, Italy.
Beautiful.
At a nerd show, which is going to be great, and that's with the Kirby Comic team there, so I'm really excited for that. We're going to check out Florence and Venice a little bit, too.
Have you been?
I might get that perfect day you were talking about.
Have you been to Florence?
No.
Ooh.
I've been to Rome and Pompeii.
Get your perfect day in Florence.
I know, I know it's not enough time. I'd probably need 2 months to just scratch the surface.
Oh, man. I'll give you, I don't know how much time you'll have there, but if you do spend a day in Florence, I'll give you a few tips.
But I do have a lot to look forward to. I've got, going back to Kansas for more instruction. I'm going to be doing the Chicago Comic Con, so C2E2. I'm going to be in Seattle, got Toronto, I got Moncton, Fan Expo, of course.
Fantastic.
I believe the Kirby Comic Art team, it's not official yet, but they may be appearing at Fan Expo. Hopefully. Yeah.
But you'll be there regardless.
I'll be there regardless.
Awesome.
If you'll have me.
I'm sure they'll be happy to have you.
I'm just hoping I get some more published work out there this year. That's all.
It's gonna happen.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'm hoping to do something a little bigger.
It'll happen.
Yes.
And that graphic novel's gonna come too.
Yeah, there's a couple nice things coming that I can't mention, but yeah, I do. It's gonna be a good year.
Awesome.
Just hope it's like just an extension of last year. Just keep it going.
It will.
Keep going uphill.
It will. 100%. I can see it.
Appreciate that.
Well, thank you again for being on the show.
Thank
Hopefully
you.
We can do this again soon when some of that work comes out. And if not, we'll even just talk more about fine art and our feelings about it.
I would be happy to. I'm always happy to talk about art and fine company. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Cheers, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Cave of Solitude. Remember, you can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow Casey Parsons on Facebook, his art, as well as Cave of Solitude on Facebook, and leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you again, and we will be back soon.